From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, deadly bombing in central Nigeria, martial law continuing in Thailand. Ethnic minorities in eastern Ukraine fear Russian intolerance. Plus, we'll find out about satellite fleet that monitors weather. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A Nigerian police official says a pair of explosions in the central city of Jos has left dozens of people dead. Witnesses say the blast went off several minutes apart near a bus terminal and a hospital, both located in a busy market area, as we hear in this excerpt from reporting by Channels TV.
Having rocked the central area of Jos, the Plateau State capital, and it's been confirmed that 46 people have been killed in the blasts. The explosions, believed to have been caused by an improvised explosive device, occurred around the busy Jos main market between the railway terminus and the temporary site of the Jos University Teaching Hospital. The first blast went off at about 3:10 this afternoon, while the second erupted about 10 meters away 15 minutes later.
There was no immediate claim of responsibility for that attack. Jos is known as a flashpoint for sectarian violence. Boko Haram militants had claimed responsibility for previous attacks in the area, including a July 2012 attack near Jos that killed at least 58 people. Nigerian lawmakers on Tuesday voted to extend a state of emergency for 6 months in the northeast, where Boko Haram is most active. And distraught mothers of the 276 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram nearly 5 weeks ago have expressed hope that the country's government will find them and bring them home. Martha Mark, who is married to the local reverend, became very emotional when she talked about her kidnapped daughter, Monica. She was breaking down in tears. Like many of those involved, Martha does not believe the Nigerian military is doing enough to rescue the girls. The girls were kidnapped in the town of Chibok, where one of the community leaders, Malam Dunama, said the residents of the town feel helpless.
It is possible they can come and kidnap the whole village and go away with it. What can we do? We don't have ammunition, only we have sticks, bow and arrow. We cannot stand these people.
Of the more than 300 girls and young women who were kidnapped from their boarding school, 53 escaped. A week ago, Boko Haram posted a video online that said to show the abducted girls claiming that they had converted to Islam. Joy Bashara was among those who managed to escape.
Many of them, I recognize them. All of them, we are in the same class. Some of them are my friends. I recognize many among them.
Esther Yakubu, whose daughter is being held hostage, is angry that government forces have taken more than a month to enter the Sambisa Forest, which, according to witnesses and unverified reports, could be where the girls are held.
Up to now, nobody have ever entered that Sambisa, and they say they know where those girls are. But up to now, no any response. No any soldier that we hear that entered that Sambisa up to today.
Nigeria's military insists that it is diligently searching for the girls and says near daily aerial bombardments of the forest were stopped to avoid accidentally hitting the girls. Leaders from Nigeria's neighboring countries, including Benin, met at a French-organized summit last weekend in Paris to coordinate curtailing the Boko Haram insurgency that threatens the region. British, U.S., and European officials also attended.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Rival political demonstrators continued with rallies in the Thai capital, Bangkok, on Tuesday night, despite the imposition of martial law earlier in the day. Thailand's powerful military chief intervened for the first time in the country's latest political crisis, declaring martial law and dispatching gun-mounted jeeps into the heart of the capital with a vow to resolve the deepening conflict as quickly as possible. Life throughout the day continued normally, with residents unfazed by the news, which follows 6 months of crippling protests that have killed 28 people and injured more than 800. As night fell on Tuesday, Thai troops maintained their watch on the pro-government Red Shirt group camped outside of the city's outskirts. And the anti-government group, the People's Democratic Reform Committee, or PDRC, also continued their rally in the old part of Bangkok. Anti-government leader Suthep Thaiksuban said despite martial law, the Constitution still exists so that we still have the right to rally peacefully, he said, without weapons. We still have the right to stand up against the government and oust them under the Constitution. And indeed, he was right. Martial law does allow them to continue with the gathering, but forbids them to march, so that for the moment at least, they are staying where they are. Mark Thompson, director of Southeast Asia Research at City University of Hong Kong, speaking now from Indonesia, told VOA's Victor Beatty, while the foreign press calls the declaration a surprise there in Thailand, the domestic media has expected it for some time.
The fact it's been going on for 6 months, the weakening of the caretaker government through the cancellation of the elections, through the constitutional court's decision to remove Yuen Lak as the prime minister, the installment of yet another caretaker, all that has contributed to political instability. And, of course, the final straw were the fatal shootings, grenade attacks just recently that killed 3 people and injured 22. The military stepping in at this point is not really a big surprise, no.
They insist that this is not a coup. Do you believe that?
Well, it is semantics, but it's an important point because, you know, the last time the military stepped in 2006, it didn't work. And the military is afraid that if they call it a coup and they actually remove the caretaker government officially, not just de facto like they're doing now in terms of really taking power, that will further provoke the red shirts and could lead the country closer to civil war, which has always been a worry.
On his official Twitter account today, former Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat said the army's declaration was expected. He hoped that no one would undermine democracy in Thailand.
That's the hope, that, you know, that even though the military is stepping in to make sure that security is handled, that the caretaker government will stay in power. I'm not sure that will really work. Because, you know, once the police powers of the government are undermined, what basis does it have to rule? Has no real power. The question then is, do elections get scheduled? I think the great concern of the Thaksin pro-government faction at the moment is that elections be set up soon enough that this whole thing gets decided by the ballot box, not by some informal, unelected committee which imposes so-called reforms, which is what the anti-government protests are calling for. And obviously they want to use those reforms to undermine the Thaksin faction.
How likely is a civil war in Thailand between the two very polarized political factions?
I still think it's a strong possibility, even if not yet probable. There are worries in Thailand, but there are also people calling for restraint. The dangerous thing, of course, is both sides are armed. It's not just the demonstrators, so-called peaceful demonstrators on both sides who have weapons, but also the military is split. We know that, at least at the lower ranks, and the police has demonstrated its sympathy for the government position, the Thaksin side. If things did deteriorate, there is a real possibility of armed conflict. So that can't be ruled out. The military intervention today, I think, the declaration of martial rule is an effort to preempt that. It's not clear, though, that will work.
Thompson says it's likely martial law will remain in effect until the country can hold elections or another government can be installed. He says the key development to watch will be whether the military urges the two sides to move toward elections, which the pro-government forces want, or will push it for an unelected reform council to run the country advocated by the opposition. Chinese President Xi Jinping on Tuesday welcomed delegates from 46 nations and global organizations to a major summit to discuss regional security challenges. Russian President Vladimir Putin, shunned by the West over Ukraine, met with Mr. Xi at the start of the two-day meeting in Shanghai. Also attending the summit are Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and Afghan President Hamid Karzai. As observer states, the U.S. and Japan have sent senior diplomats. At a summit banquet on Tuesday, President Xi called for an all-Asian nations to work hand-in-hand, as he put it, for peace and development in the region. The Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia formally opens later today. And in the port city of Wusong earlier on Tuesday, Mr. Xi and President Putin launched a week-long round of joint Russia-China maritime exercises. Mr. Putin is also hoping to extend his country's dealings with Asia and diversify markets for its gas, which now goes mostly to Europe. Russia has been negotiating for more than a decade now on a proposed 30-year deal to supply gas to China. Officials said they hope to complete work in time to sign a contract while Mr. Putin is in Shanghai.
I'm Ira Melman with an invitation for you to come and visit the American Cafe. It's a place where you can come and get a taste of America, from the bitter to the sweet. This past week, the United States recognized some mistakes it had made in the past.
Some of these soldiers fought and died for a country that did not always see them as equal.
For some in the Asian American communities, some stereotypes, although positive, are not always helpful.
What ends up happening is that we don't see what problems actually exist under the surface.
And then there are those who put it all on the line at a very popular festival in the capital city of Texas.
I don't know what to do with my life, but I really, 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 really want to be famous.
Come and visit the American Cafe. We have a new program for you every week. You can hear it on the radio, on the web, or iTunes, or at voanews.com. Come join us. No reservation necessary.
Russia's defense ministry says its 40,000 army troops near the Ukraine border have started dismantling their positions. NATO and U.S. government officials have said they have seen no immediate sign of withdrawal. Meantime, the United Nations Refugee Agency says 10,000 civilians have been displaced so far by the unrest in Ukraine and that the number continues to rise. In a statement Tuesday, the UN said it's providing legal assistance, cash and grants, and improved shelter for the displaced people. Ukraine's government says 32 pro-Russian activists who died during a fire in a building that they had taken over earlier this month in Odessa may have been killed by chloroform poisoning, not by flames or smoke. The revelation fueled speculation about what happened during day-long clashes back on May 2nd. But as VOA's Al Pessin reports from Odessa, people seem eager not to return to the level of emotion that led to that violence.
The trade union's building at Kulikovo Field bears the scars of a raging fire, and the communist flag raised by pro-Russian protesters still flies on the roof behind a Ukrainian flag placed at half-staff to mark their deaths. Inside, the intensity of the fire is clear, and barricades the pro-Russian protesters used to block the doors helped fuel it. But photos of the dead, too graphic to show, indicate some of them died in unusual positions, apparently not trying to flee or protect themselves from the fire. And many of the rooms were not burned, and some exits are clear. On Monday, Ukraine's deputy interior minister said the victims may have died from chloroform poisoning, and the investigation into how that might have happened is continuing. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov expressed outrage and accused Ukrainian authorities of lying to cover up the involvement of foreign mercenaries. Odessa's regional vice governor, Zoya Kazanji, told VOA there's no tolerance for such interference.
No, this, однозначная, резко отрицательная.
My attitude is obviously extremely negative. At high levels, we are constantly saying this is our business. Unfortunately, I think the political conditions and the behavior of senior Russian officials is causing a situation where we will hardly be able to be brothers and sisters and friendly nations in the foreseeable future.
Journalist Oksana Butuk says the Russian approach will backfire even among Odessa's pro-Russian activists.
People who are still gathering at Kulikova Field always say they're there because they want to be there and that Russia has nothing to do with it. And when Russia tries to get involved, people get aggressive because they're always saying Russia is not involved.
People who still come to pay their respects at the Kulikova Field building are emotional. But even they don't talk about seceding from Ukraine like activists in some areas farther east do.
Ukraine is Ukraine. No one was going to separate it in the way the media shows it, mostly national media. Odessa was never for the separation of Ukraine.
Monday's revelations are fueling doubt and anger at the authorities, but Vice Governor Kazanji says they will not likely spark more violence.
The most important thing is to know the truth of what happened, because it's the only thing that could somehow, if not reconcile the city, at least calm people down, because the truth is always calming.
So she and the rest of the new regional government are focused on completing the investigation in the hope that speculation about the horrors of May 2nd doesn't lead to more of the same. Al Pessin, VOA News, Odessa.
Donetsk in eastern Ukraine is a cosmopolitan city home to Tatars, Jews, Turks, Greeks, and international students who've come from all over the world to study medicine. But some of the city's minorities fear that increased Russian influence will lead to intolerance of ethnic and religious diversity. Patrick Wells is in Donetsk with more.
After 6 long years of study, these Jordanian students have finally qualified as medical doctors. But this isn't a university in Amman. This is Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Thousands of students from around the world have come here to take advantage of affordable tuition fees. But now the university is telling them to go home, fearing it can't guarantee their safety in the current political climate.
Before now and now, I think for now it's more tense. Before, there were risks that we went through. But now it gets more high. We have many risks now we are facing.
Some students say they faced increased suspicion and racist abuse since the pro-Russian separatist movement began. Michael, a dentistry student from Botswana, says separatists recently shouted racial slurs at him and his friends in the street.
Especially us, as in black people. I was in a situation last time where I was associated with Obama. Because we are of the same color, they hate that guy, so they thought we should just go back to our countries, just like that. So it's very difficult in that situation.
Donetsk is also home to Tatars, Armenians, Azerbaijanis, Greeks, and Jews, many of whom say they've enjoyed increased freedom of identity and religion since the fall of the Soviet Union. Mufti Sayyid Ismagilov heads the local Muslim community on the outskirts of Donetsk. He says Muslims in Ukraine enjoy many more rights and freedoms than their co-religionists across the border in Russia.
The most important reason why we support Ukraine is that there are many rights and freedoms for us here in Ukraine, which give us the opportunity to develop here. If we compare Ukraine and Russia, here is much better.
Ismagilov also fears what separation from Ukraine and increased Russian influence here might mean for the region's many religious and ethnic minorities.
There was and there still is trust between people from different religions and cultures, Christians, Jews, and atheists. We can easily find a common language. There is no xenophobia, fascism, or racism here. There are no skinheads like in Russia.
As preparations continue for this Sunday's presidential election, many hope the results will create a system of governance that will continue to protect the rights of minorities. But election officials say they're already facing intimidation and threats in parts of eastern Ukraine, and it's unclear whether the vote will go ahead in these areas. Patrick Wells, VOA News, Donetsk, Ukraine.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
The 2014 hurricane season predictions are due out later this week. They're expected to show the general weather trends over the next 6 months. But the accuracy of such long-range forecasts is often criticized, especially when they turn out to be wrong. For this story, we traveled to the U.S. Satellite Operations Facility near Washington to get a closer look at the tools meteorologists use to make their forecast. Here's VOA's Roseanne Skirbel.
Tom Boyd sits before a bank of computers that streams live data from weather satellites.
As we speak, we're looking at what is happening on the satellite. This schedule is actually happening on the satellite. It tells the imager and sounder when to start and stop and where to scan at over the U.S.
The imager works like a camera in space, and the sounder measures the temperature radiated from clouds, oceans, and air. Boyd is among the dozens of aerospace engineering technicians in the control room who gather that data and make sure the satellites run properly around the clock.
Earlier, we had a special event on this particular satellite. We just kind of brought it out of semi-storage and just started up the schedule. So we're expecting to see a few limits flag out until the thing settles down to satellite, probably over the next 24-hour period.
NOAA's fleet includes 16 satellites. Some remain in a set position over the United States. Others constantly circle the globe. The challenge is to get as accurate a picture of the atmosphere as possible, says Mike Condre, deputy director of NOAA's Office of Satellite Operations.
They give you the temperature, the winds, the humidity, the kind of information, and that is data is put into the computer models that the National Weather Service runs, and those computer models are what give people the long-term forecasts, 3 days, 5 days, 7 day forecasts to prepare.
And those long-term forecasts can save lives.
Every time we see a hurricane, every time we see any kind of severe weather out there, that underscores the importance to the folks out here on the floor of what they do every day.
Condre expects predictions to get even better with the launch of the Joint Polar Satellite System in early 2017.
What these will provide is about an order of magnitude, in other words, about 10 times more volume of data on the atmospheric state of the winds, the temperature, and the humidity in the atmosphere.
That information will improve the day-to-day forecast. Seasonal forecasts rely on even more data sources. In addition to satellites, they depend on ocean buoys that record sea temperatures and observations from ships. NOAA and Colorado State University issue annual hurricane reports to let planners and the public know what to expect. Warmer than normal waters in the tropical Pacific generally indicate fewer storms in the Atlantic. CSU research scientist Philip Klotzbach mines the tropical Atlantic for similar clues. He spoke via Skype.
If the waters are warmer than normal, that tends to mean there's more fuel for the developing storms. If the atmospheric pressures are lower than normal, that tends to mean the atmosphere is more unstable and more conducive for storms to form and to intensify.
But errors do occur. An active Atlantic hurricane season was predicted last year. That didn't happen.
It is certainly very difficult to predict and is very complicated because the atmosphere and the ocean interact in a very complicated manner, and you have to take into account a lot of these complicated relationships when you're issuing these seasonal predictions.
But Klotzbach says mistakes better inform the next forecast, adding prediction remains an inexact science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Species of snake that had been lost for almost 80 years has been rediscovered on a remote Mexican island, more than 650 kilometers off Mexico's Pacific coast. The original, and until recently the only, spotting of the Clarion nightsnake was made by an American naturalist in 1936 on a visit to the island. He returned from his trip with one snake preserved in a glass jar. Subsequent visits failed to find more nightsnakes, and no further sightings were reported over the years from the island, which is inhabited only by a small detachment of Mexican Marines. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On May 21st, 1840, Navy Captain William Hobson formally declared New Zealand a British colony. Hobson became New Zealand's first governor. In 1856, the Midwestern town of Lawrence, Kansas, on the American frontier, was captured and burned by pro-slavery forces. The battle between opponents and proponents of slavery led the state to be known as Bleeding Kansas. In 1863, the Seventh-day Adventist Church was organized in Battle Creek, Michigan. The church is distinct from other Protestant denominations in that its members observe Saturday, the seventh day of the week, as the day of worship rather than Sunday. Today, the SDA Church has millions of members worldwide. In 1881, the American Red Cross was established by Clara Barton in Washington, D.C. Football's governing body, FIFA, was organized on this day in 1904. Representatives from seven European football associations met to arrange an international tournament, but it wasn't until 1930 that the first World Cup was held. In 1908, the first horror movie, a silent version of the Robert Louis Stevenson classic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, premiered in Chicago, Illinois. In 1924, University of Chicago students Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold Jr. murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks in a thrill killing. It became one of the most notorious murders of the 20th century and provided the basis for the movie Rope. In 1991, Ethiopia's Marxist president, Mengistu Haile Mariam, resigned and fled his country under pressure from advancing rebels. The dictator oversaw the Ethiopian Red Terror in the 1970s, in which thousands were killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Events in Ukraine have made clear that Europe still lives in a dangerous world. There is no postmodern refuge immune to the threat of military force, said U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. And we cannot take for granted, even in Europe, that peace is underwritten by the credible deterrent of military power. In the short term, the Transatlantic Alliance has responded to Russian actions with continued resolve. While Ukraine is not a member of NATO and is not seeking NATO membership, Russia's actions are still of concern to NATO members because, over the long term, Russia is likely to test NATO's purpose, stamina, and commitment. Future generations will note whether at this moment, said Secretary Hagel, we summoned the will to invest in our alliance. We must not squander this opportunity or shrink from this challenge. We will be judged harshly by history and by future generations if we do. NATO members must demonstrate that they are as committed to this alliance as its founding members were, who built it 65 years ago. They must reaffirm the security guarantees at the heart of the alliance. They must reinvigorate the unrivaled joint planning, exercises, and capabilities that are its lifeblood. And ultimately, they must be prepared to invest more resources in their militaries. Defense investment not only helps grow economies, but it deters the higher costs of future conflict. But investing in NATO means more than just military investment. It means the U.S. and Europe must partner together over the long term to bolster Europe's energy security and blunt Russia's coercive energy policies. By the end of the decade, Europe is positioned to reduce its natural gas imports from Russia by more than 25%. And the U.S. Department of Energy has conditionally approved export permits for American liquefied natural gas that add up to more than half of Europe's gas imports from Russia. The United States remains committed to the NATO alliance. Without deep engagement in the world, said Secretary Hagel, America would face more conflict, not less, and on the terms of our adversaries, not on our own terms. That is why America's commitment to its allies in Europe and around the world is not a burden. It's not a luxury, but it is a necessity, and it must be unwavering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.